The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves. And Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way, today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 144. With me tonight, I have four guests, Lisa Stiles, Margaret Harding, John Wheeler, and Dan Yerman. All five of us attended the American Nuclear Society winter meeting last week and thought we'd get together and do a wrap-up for you and talk about other things that are happening in the nuclear technology fields. I'll start off the introductions with Lisa Stiles.
This is Lisa Stiles. My background's nuclear engineering. Haven't done that for 2 years, though. I do workforce planning, but I'm still in the nuclear, pro-nuclear outreach realm, and so I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Rod.
Margaret?
I'm also a nuclear engineer by training, been doing nuclear engineer core design, fuel design, and that kind of thing, as well as leading engineering teams for one of the big vendors for a number of years. In the beginning of this year, I decided it was time to become my own boss and started my own consulting company, consulting with new businesses trying to get into nuclear because of the renaissance, as well as helping some of the current companies in nuclear do their jobs better. Technically as well as business-wise.
John?
Thanks for inviting us on, Ron. This is John Wheeler with This Week in Nuclear, and I am a marine engineer by formal education and a reactor operator by training, and I've been in the nuclear industry about 25 years managing a number of different functions. And like Lisa, right now I am managing workforce planning and workforce development for Entergy, who is my employer in my day job.
And Dan?
This is Dan Yerman. Currently, I'm a consultant to the nuclear industry, primarily in the area of marketing, communications, and business development. That's something I did for 19 years at the Idaho National Laboratory, where I worked in technology licensing and in spinoffs of technologies from the Department of Energy lab into the commercial sector. Happy to be here.
Great. And last week, all five of us attended at various times the American Nuclear Society winter meeting. I decided to get us all together because a meeting as large and as busy as that meeting, nobody can get a full scope of what happened. And so I wanted to get some impressions from each of these fine guests and see what they think about the meeting and what it bodes for nuclear technologies and nuclear sciences, and of course the nuclear power industry. So anybody can go ahead and start.
Oh, this is Dan. I'll kick it off by mentioning a little self-referential news, which is the four of us attended a nuclear blogger meetup that was an extension of the dialogue we began at the Atlanta ANS meeting last June. We had about 45 people came out to talk about new social media, nuclear blogs, all four of us were there. By the way, I want to thank...
Actually, Dan, there's five of us on the line.
Five of us there. Beg your pardon. I have four icons on my Skype thing, so I counted four. Sorry about that. We had a little talk by Areva about their outreach to nuclear blogs. They also provided some support for us, as did Cool Hand Nuke, a spinoff from Entergy down in New Orleans. So we much appreciate that. There's going to be some follow-up communication, I hope, among everyone who was there. But I thought it was very good to see people come out and talk about their views. William Tucker, who's the author of Terrestrial Energy and also now a consultant to Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander, asked everyone for a single idea about what he could take back as a message. Of course, he didn't get a single idea. He got 45, but that's what happens when you ask for input from a bunch of nuclear bloggers.
Well, he asked for a single idea, and each one of us gave him a single idea.
Exactly.
Okay, and Lisa, I had the pleasure of sitting next to you at that blogger meeting. What did you think about getting a bunch of communicators together in one room?
Well, it's not the first time we've gotten a bunch of people together in one room. We've had sessions before on blogging and other uses of other types of media. But I think it's the first time where it was sort of a round table type of discussion instead of prepared slides or presentations. And I was just impressed that there are people from all different parts of the industry interested in taking the message out, and that we're all interested in maybe coordinating a little better to counter some of the misinformation that's out there.
Yeah, John, I had the opportunity to listen to your most recent podcast today, and you and April Slip got together and did some countering of misinformation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I will. That it was a lot of fun. And I agree with Lisa on the blogger meetup. It was really a lot of fun and very rewarding to get together finally with so many people that we've made connections with through the social media. And many of them I had never met face-to-face but had, you know, corresponded with for months or even years. And it was just really, really it was fun and very satisfying to get together as a group and collaborate. And one of the things that happened this morning is I got out of bed a little later than normal. I happened to be on a flight until late last night, got in about midnight. So I slept until 9 and got up and, you know, turned on the computer and looked at my Twitter feed and saw that there was something going on at Three Mile Island. And April Schlipp had posted some tweets about a spill that they had yesterday that was really being mischaracterized in the media. It's being called a leak at Three Mile Island, or actually radioactive leak at Three Mile Island, which was really not at all the case. It was a minor, relatively minor spill of radioactive dust and airborne metallic particles that occurred during a maintenance activity inside their containment. When things like that happen, utilities are pretty conservative, and they secured the area. They stopped all the work. They checked out all the people. They found that a few people who were kind of on the periphery of the area outside of the contaminated area boundary were not dressed in anti-contamination clothing, and some of the material got out to that area, and a few of them got some on their skin, and they had to be washed to get the material off of them. But it was really, you know, if you'd read the media reports and or watched the news on CNN or ABC News, you would think that there was a major disaster unfolding before your eyes. So it was nice to be able to take advantage of the social media and get some information out there to really kind of tell the other side of the story.
I think one of the things that I learned at the ANS meeting is that, you know, a lot of the stuff that we deal with is pretty complicated for people who, you know, in many school systems, they didn't even take chemistry or physics, and their math stops at arithmetic. So we have to learn how to speak in terms that people can understand and try to help the traditional media journalists understand what it is we're all about and why we get so excited about the technology that we're getting excited about. How many of you actually were able to attend some of the keynote sessions on Monday morning with the politicians making their various pitches?
I was there.
I was there as well.
And this is Dan. I was there, so I'll follow third. Lisa's first, I think.
Yep.
Oh, What specifically were you asking about, Rod?
Well, specifically, you know, one of the things that people have thought about nuclear for a long time is that it's kind of an issue that's only supported by people on the right side of the political equation or the Republican Party, and there certainly was not that impression at all based on what I was able to read about the keynote sessions.
Right. No, there was support on the other side of the aisle too, or across political spectrums. The head of the building construction trades from AFL-CIO, Mark Ayers, was there expressing his support for nuclear, and there was a joint bill legislation that was introduced jointly by Senators Alexander and,
James Webb.
That's right, my senator. That's bad. Yes.
I won't tell him that you live in Virginia.
Yeah. So Senator Alexander and Senator Jim Webb used the opportunity to introduce to propose legislation that's very favorable towards nuclear as part of a broader energy policy. So there was definite support for nuclear from all the speakers, and definitely from some in camps that you traditionally don't associate with strong nuclear supporters.
Margaret, you've been around the industry a long time.
I sure have. This was actually the first conference I'd been to in a number of years. My prior employer limited who attended these conferences, and I hadn't been since somewhere in the mid-80s. And it was really exciting to be there and to actually see the level of public support. I know that I've seen the plannings, the booklet for years, and having the number of political influencers in the room talking to us was really amazing. Even back in the day when it was strictly we'll call it a Republican issue, you didn't get people coming and talking to the American Nuclear Society because they didn't want to be tainted with being nuclear. So it was very exciting to see that. And then the across the aisle thing was also very, very interesting, as well as having the perspective of, hey, we're talking about jobs here. We're talking about things that are really for everybody and not just a high tech academic discussion of the nuclear technology. So it was a very exciting session, I thought. Very positive for the most part. Walked away from it very excited about being a nuke again.
Dan?
The plenary session, I think, was also remarkable for some of the things that were said by nominally a Democrat, which is Gregory Jasko, the now chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. His comments really startled quite a few people because he had some fairly significant complaints about not only the NRC's workload, but also how the nuclear industry is working with the NRC, or not working, if you take Jasko's view on things. He said that unless the nuclear industry starts following the agency's processes better for reactor design review and licensing, at least more to the agency's liking in any case, he said, quote, the NRC could not be predictable or timely in its responses, which is basically saying if you want to sell your reactor, you have to get certified by us, and if you want to get certified by us, you have to play by our rules. So it's a pretty tough message. On the other hand, the industry has some issues with people doing the reviews kind of learning by requests for additional information, or RAIs, as they're called in the lingo. And the one particularly compelling term that came up
you're going in, there
in the discussion, that's zombie RAIs, which are requests for information that are asked over and over again because different engineers keep getting the review package and then start their learning curve from scratch.
Yeah, I was at a workshop on new reactor licensing, and I asked one of the NRC presenters, if they had any kind of database of all these questions with their responses so that, you know, new license applicants can recognize what questions are going to be asked, and so that the NRC can keep track of what responses they've received and which ones are acceptable and that kind of thing. And he gave me kind of a blank look, and he says, well, there's a list of these questions on our website. And I said, that doesn't sound much like a database to me.
They actually have a database available to them, but for a variety of internal reasons have chosen not to use it. Friends tell me, here's I'm going to be a little bit careful, but they are, the accusation that the industry is not being timely is there is a two-way street going on there. When the industry is timely, the NRC isn't prepared because they're expecting things to be late and counting on that to give them time to get their jobs done. So there's a lot of concern on the part of the people trying to do the work that the NRC is ill-prepared for the level of effort that's occurring. I think they're making a good job, and I think the people doing the reviews are trying their best to do the job and do it right. But I have questions. I have deep questions about the adequacy of the training and the ability of the staff to get it all done.
I want to jump back in on this, on the issue of small reactors. I attended a session on Wednesday on small reactors, and Michael Mayfield, who heads up the new reactor, advanced reactors unit, was on a panel with four vendors of small reactors, including NuScale, Hyperion, Babcock & Wilcox, and Toshiba. He took a fair amount of heat, not only from the vendors, but also from the audience, because the agency is completely unprepared to do reviews of small reactors. And this is despite receiving, you know, funding from Congress, and they've had plenty of time to know that these requests are coming. And it's been talking about small reactors for a couple of years now, at least three. So why isn't the NRC looking at this strategically, I guess, is my question. It's okay, this technology is coming. We ought to be ramping up, looking at our standard review process, seeing where the gaps are, and starting to work this. Instead, what the NRC has said, and this is from an interview I did with Dale Klein last June, which he repeated when I talked to him at this conference, which is, show me a customer and then we'll take small reactors seriously. I'm thinking, wait a minute, is that your job? Hold it.
They're actually doing that to the big plants as well. Apparently that quote was used with GE.
Yeah, that's an issue when, you know, we talk about that they don't seem to have the resources to review the applications expeditiously. And to some extent, and I'm not a huge fan of Chairman Yatsko, but to some extent, he had a point in saying that if you don't submit quality applications, we can't ensure a timely review. And I've heard that from some NRC staff, that there are some applications that have been put in that are much better quality than others. And so, some of the onus has to be back on the companies that have submitted. But when you're trying to stretch your resources, for an influx of applications, you've got to have some way to prioritize. I was disturbed with what Chairman Yatsko said about that the industry may be complacent and distracted when it comes to maintenance. And I know a lot of other professionals in the industry were disturbed by that too. And it's instructive for everybody to remember that Greg Yatsko was Harry Reid's energy guy for many years. In fact, in 2002, I organized a session at the ANS winter meeting where we had staffers on the Hill, including Christine Savinicki and Chairman Yatsko. We were trying to get those that were characterized as relatively pro-nuclear and those that were relatively anti-nuclear. And I'm afraid to say he hasn't had anything good to say. He didn't have anything to say good to say about the industry then. I think he's come around now somewhat, but it's difficult to hear him say things like that, like what he said about the maintenance in the industry when those of us that work at power plants see the planning and the investment that we make in our equipment, you know, day after day, year after year.
Well, I have to agree with you, Lisa, and speaking strictly as a private citizen and not as a representative of my daytime employer, I think that the chairman was way out of line. And I believe that the data, if you look at the industry data, does not support his statement that the industry is not doing a good job maintaining the plants. You know, capacity factors.
Excellent job.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you. And frankly, as I had said in comments earlier about Chairman Yasko's remarks, there's plenty of blame to go around. On the new plant build, if the vendor, the licensees, I know in some cases did not do a great job in the initial pass because they felt that things would somehow the NRC should know or they shouldn't have to document as much detail. So they deserve a shot for not having gotten that done. But the NRC isn't doing an adequate job. And on that same note, in the current operating fleet, they have raided their experienced reviewers. So they tried to split the number of new people coming into the NRC so that what should be routine reviews and approvals in the staff have become extremely onerous for the engineering staff at the utilities to get through the review staff at the NRC on a routine reload licensing matter. So there's blame on both sides, and just to sit there and smack the industry so publicly was really out of line.
Right.
This is Dan. Building on Margaret's comments, I really feel strongly that Chairman Yasko owes it to the industry to be more proactive than just complaining and then sitting on his hands when the paperwork goes south. Wrapping knuckles, metaphorically speaking, at an ANS conference is certainly an effective way to get the industry's attention. But my question is, after getting it on Monday, what's he going to do about it on Tuesday? So like Ricky Ricardo once said to Lucille Ball, "Lucy, you got some explaining to do." I think if there was more explaining and less complaining, we'd get more interaction with the NRC that was effective and maybe a lot sooner.
Well, and honest, the vendors, the licensees are very reluctant to take the NRC to task because they pay. Going into the NRC and saying, "You're not doing your job right," does not result in getting better reviews and more competent reviewers. It results in poor cooperation and increased animosity between the two, which makes it even harder to get your stuff approved. So
and
there's
higher
no
bills.
And higher bills. It's a very expensive process. So it's very hard for the industry to say to the NRC, "We need you to help us get this right." And so the NRC needs to be doing a better job of looking at itself and saying, "What are we doing to do the best reviews we can, the most efficient reviews we can, and to help and to make sure the industry does the job right?" That's their job, but that we are effective in what we do as well.
And one of the things I think that we need to do is to at least in some ways recognize the constraints that the NRC is under as a government organization and what their rules tell them they have to do, which is to, they have to go through the budget process, for example, to get the resources. And as a guy who's been doing the federal budget process for the last 8 years, you have to look 3 years in advance to get your resources. And right now, I've pulled some of these guys into the hallway and said, why aren't you able to say, "Well, listen, our licensees pay the bills, so if we need more resources, we should simply add them and bill," rather than waiting for 3 years for Congress to make a decision to increase our resources?
Actually, go ahead.
They say they can't do that.
It's actually more complicated than that. When you talk to the NRC directly as a licensee, which I was at one point with my prior position, the fees that we pay as licensees don't directly go into the NRC's coffers. So it doesn't matter if you are willing to pay for way more review work. They're actually budgeted. It's a very strange process, and it's not direct at all.
Right. So that's what the point I was trying to make was that the NRC can't really get that changed. That's a political decision that people like us have the ability to talk to our congressman and say, "Listen, this is a problem. This is causing increased emissions and higher electricity costs and everything else. We have to fix this problem."
Well, you know, you're right. We really need a ground up overhaul of the whole fee structure and financing structure for how the NRC gets their reviews done. For example, you know, the industry has been paying an excise tax for the last 30 years on all the electricity that is sold. One mil per kilowatt hour of electricity that goes into the Nuclear Waste Trust Fund. Well, the government has squandered that money. And that is essentially money that is supposed to go for a long-term storage solution. Well, and it's not. So why not take some of that money and put it back in to the NRC now in a way that will help the country?
Well, that would take legislation.
Right. It would.
Yeah.
And the restructuring of how the NRC is funded and staffed would take legislation to change.
Yeah, so. That's true. With the nuclear waste fund, what people don't talk about much is that the taxpayers, the ratepayers, are paying three times. That they've paid, and when they pay for their electricity, then when companies like, gosh, I almost said my company's name. I'm not going to do that tonight. And other companies that are doing dry storage, they're paying again because those companies have to spend money that they wouldn't have had to spend if the government had kept their commitment. And then those companies are suing the federal government and winning, and that money is coming from taxpayers. Of course, when Yucca Mountain got defunded, basically slashed, taken off the table, the administration promised a blue ribbon panel to look at what a used fuel management in this country would look like as far as temporary storage, final disposal, recycling. And to my knowledge, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, there's been no talk of that blue ribbon panel since.
Actually, there has been some discussion about the blue ribbon panel, but no names have come out.
I have just one additional thing to add to Margaret's, and that is that journalist from a major mainstream newspaper who I cannot name told me at the ANS conference that he interviewed Secretary Chu just before he went with President Obama to China and said, well, okay, where's the blue ribbon panel? And Chu says, we're getting closer. And he asked him, well, how much closer? He said, much closer. So I don't know what that means, but apparently he's there making some progress. I also was told that Chu has personally interviewed some of the candidates for the panel. I would assume there's also White House vetting involved.
Well, as much as I admire Secretary Chu, he said exactly the same words when he was confirmed in his position about the loan guarantee programs. That was at least 10 months ago.
I was interviewed by Clean Skies TV on the loan guarantees, and they asked me what's holding it up. And I said, I think that the solar and wind people and the green wing of the Democratic Party's found a new angle relative to that. And they've basically said to the Obama administration, look, as far as Wall Street investment is concerned, you're giving us loan guarantees, and we appreciate it because investment money's starting to flow. But if you give loan guarantees to the nuclear industry, that money's going to start flowing the other way because there's much bigger returns to be made. And, of course, if you guys back it up, that's where the money will go. So I think there's some zero-sum politicking going on with loan guarantees. The Obama administration has hired a new executive in charge of loan guarantees and now has him reporting directly to Secretary Chu. The guy has sterling credentials, but I don't know whether he's going to be any more effective than the last one.
Yeah, here's the other issue that I heard about loan guarantees, it's the real holdup is the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, wants to charge a much higher default fee than the industry believes is acceptable.
Yeah, I heard that too.
And I think that's a red herring because the OMB knows perfectly well that these loan guarantees are designed to be cost effective if the industry won't sign up. And I'm concerned that it represents some thinking on some within the administration that if we make the loan guarantees too expensive, then the industry won't take them, and then it becomes self-fulfilling. They can say, well, you know, we offered these things to the industry, and they didn't sign up for them, so I don't know what the complaining's about. I worked in budget in Washington for 14 years, and I had lots and lots of contact with OMB, and I smell a rat.
Were they saying that the cost to default would be more for one technology over another, or would be just too high for everybody?
What they're saying is that they want to go back to the 2003 study that they, which wasn't really a study, by the way, it simply made the assumption that 50% of the loans would default, and they wanted to use that as the basis for calculating the fee. Regardless of what has changed in the marketplace since 2003, like the price of natural gas and the fact that there's probably going to be a price on carbon and a few other things that make nuclear plants far more competitive.
Well, was the default fee the same for nuclear as it was for or any other technology? Was the default fee the same or?
No, it's just for the default fee would be set for nuclear as 50% of the loans would default, which caused you to go through the calculation and come up with a fee. I think the number I was hearing was that the OMB wanted to charge the loan applicant a close to $1 billion in upfront fees to get the loan guarantee.
And the thing that concerns me about this, Rod, is that the Energy Policy Act of 2005 requires the Department of Energy to do fairly significant due diligence, and that's where that list of four firms, that you've previously talked about on these podcasts came from. They looked at the applications, and they said these guys have the best chances in terms of reactor technology, the rate structure, the fact that construction while in progress is available in the state, and a whole bunch of other factors make these the best prospects and the least likely to default. So the due diligence measure, which was not in place in 2003 and which is part of the current legislation, is driving DOE to make high-quality selections, which is another reason why I think OMB raising this issue of fees represents political disputes within the Obama administration and an effort, I think, by some to derail the loan guarantees by making them too expensive for the industry to participate.
I won't argue at all with your analysis. And by the way, people who have fingers should count on your fingers. August of 2005, it is now November of 2009. That was the process that the DOE went through to do their due diligence and come up with the four best applicants. So a four-year due diligence should be plenty.
Yeah, and we're completely ignoring the tax advantages that wind and solar generators get. And I did a show, an interview a couple of weeks ago of an economist and nuclear engineer who has done some look at the appreciation schedules and how that affects investment. And if I invest in a wind energy facility, the first year that it goes into operation, I can recoup approximately 30% of my investment in tax credits. They have a 3.5 year depreciation schedule for wind, compared to a 22-year depreciation schedule for nuclear. You know, so for the wind folks to come with their hat in hand, being concerned that their subsidies are going to go the way of the nuclear industry is just really disingenuous, because they don't really need loan guarantees. Their accelerated depreciation schedule gives them a guaranteed return on investment that is far greater than the return that they'll get from the energy that they sell.
Right. Of course, that assumes that
$21 per megawatt hour direct subsidy fee also helps.
I have to make a smart remark. That assumes that the turbine actually stays up
for three years.
It's very, very. Yeah. I think there's a reason why they have a 3.5 year depreciation schedule, because that's about as long as
the lifetime of the turbine.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the turbine manufacturers are warranting the turbines for 20 years.
Well, they might be warranting them for 20 years, but that doesn't mean they're lasting that long.
Well, that's true. And what will happen is that they won't last that long, and then somebody will be on the hook to go back and sue them to recover a cost.
I lived for a number of years in Northern California and enjoyed driving through the forest of failed windmills in Altamont Pass. Yeah. Their track record isn't great. But that's sort of the interesting part of the problem is it appears to be new and shiny on the hill. So people think that this is something they ought to be investing in, I guess. And sadly, it's the wrong choices. It's not sustainable. It's not feasible.
Yeah, but see, the good thing is for the politically speaking, the natural gas industry loves windmills.
That's because they have to replace 85% of the power signed up for but with the windmill with natural gas turbines.
Right. That's Tim Wirth, who is a former senator, spoke in front of the Colorado Oil and Gas Association this summer and told them that they should be giving the wind and solar industry a big teddy bear hug and walking close in hand to Congress, you know, supporting wind and solar because when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine,
they run a gas turbine.
Exactly.
By the way, I got that data of 85% replacement at the Smart Grid conference in September. I was the only nuclear consultant in the room, and the Smart Grid people were talking about the fact that Smart Grid really isn't green because it requires them to buy, to have on hand for wind anyway. Well, for all, quote, renewables, they have to have 85% of the power available in a non-renewable, in a fossil fuel, gas, coal, whatever, to back up.
Yep. And redundant transmission and distribution systems.
Exactly. And so the expense in Smart Grid, and that was one of the reasons I've been skewering Smart Grid. Smart Grid is incredibly expensive, and a lot of the expense is to deal with a renewable that's fundamentally not working anyway.
Yeah, and what happens if something's incredibly expensive? That means somebody's making an incredible amount of money selling it.
Yep.
One of the things I've tried to make as a case for nuclear relative to smart grid and renewables is I've pointed out that nuclear pays the rent for transmission and distribution facilities, and that if solar and wind had any sense at all, they would hook up with T&D that was being supported by output from nuclear plants that could ride on top of it. The people who build long-distance transmission lines know that nuclear and solar don't have the capital to pay for new transmission, so they're basically parasitic in their use of the grids. And if they were smart, they would line up with nuclear plants, which are keeping the grid humming.
Well, here's something that I've started to do some numbers on, because we talk a lot about the capacity factor of power plants and the fact that, you know, if you can keep the power plant running near its optimal capacity, it produces a much larger stream of revenue and actually reduces the cost per unit. But something that people haven't talked much about is the fact that a transmission system that goes out to a renewable or energy system, a offshore windmill or a desert power plant, is not going to be running at a very high capacity factor either. It's going to have to be sized to carry the maximum amount of electricity that distributed source can provide, but most of the time it's going to be empty. The power lines are going to be sitting there not carrying any power, not collecting any fees for transmission, and making it far more expensive for those few kilowatt hours that go past.
That's why there's incredible, and I have to say the disclaimer is my son's getting his degree in energy storage technology, but that's why there's huge resources being put into energy storage technology research, because until you put energy storage on these non-consistent sources, they're useless. And so you have to come up with a viable means of storing large amounts of energy and then reeling them back out on the grid. Then you can start to take that high, expensive transmission line and keep it full. But it means that you build windmills for three times the actual expected use so that you can be storing two-thirds of it at any given time so that you can always have some coming back for the two-thirds of the time they're not available.
Well, the problem with batteries, and I don't know of any storage technology that overcomes this problem, is that you lose about between 30% and 50% of the energy that you put into it never comes back out.
Well, that's exactly what all the research is about, and trying to figure out ways to make that more efficient and more effective. And I'm not saying it's out there. I'm just But the reason I said the disclaimer is because my son's getting his PhD in that, and I have to support him, right? So I'm not going to sit here and say
it's supporting him.
No, actually, I'm not. He got a full ride scholarship to MIT, so I ain't paying a dime. That's what he's really interested in. He and I have had lots of long discussions about it. And his comment, as pro renewables as the kid is, he's also pro nuclear, by the way, is it doesn't work without storage. It does not work without viable, large energy storage. Hence why he's researching it.
Hence the reason I say it simply doesn't work.
Well, yeah, that was my comment back.
Because the unicorn doesn't exist.
Yep.
Well, you could say the same thing about carbon capture and sequestration, too.
And I do.
I know. I mean, if you look at the energy required, it's 20 to 30% of the output of the coal plant would go back into trying to contain, strip out and contain the carbon. And then you still have to have a place to put it. And we're talking about volumes of material on a planetary scale.
Right.
It's immense volumes.
Right. Material that has had a history of when it burps out, it kills people.
Yeah.
Let's talk about carbon capture from the point of view of the different sectors that emit carbon. And in this case, I'm going to compare transportation with stationary sources. One of the great shifts that took place in terms of burdens with the Clean Air Act is that the coal industry was very successful in putting tremendous regulation on automobiles, shifting the burden of pollution control for various kinds of priority pollutants from coal plants to cars. Now, if you push carbon sequestration, the coal utilities are going to have the same fight all over again. They're going to say, well, wait a minute, what are you doing about sequestering carbon coming off from cars? And the automobile industry is going to say what? What are you talking about? So you have a problem here with who's going to carry the regulatory burden. And I was reading an interview that Jim Rogers, the CEO of Duke Energy, had with the Council of Foreign Relations on November 18th. This was cited in Keith Johnson's Environmental Capital blog on the Wall Street Journal, which is how I found it. And he said there are 25 states that get their primary electricity supply from coal. That's half the states. So anything that Congress does with carbon cap and trade or carbon taxes or carbon sequestration has to deal with an enormously significant group of people who have very significant interests at heart. And so I'm somewhat skeptical that we're going to see carbon sequestration emerge anytime soon.
And if we can, if we can't be trusted to sequester, you know, metal nuclear fuel inside metal casks inside a mountain, why does anybody have any confidence that we can put carbon under the ground for any length of time? I bet this doesn't make sense to me.
Right. I mean, carbon dioxide is a gas. Gases tend to ooze out of things. That's what they do.
It's a lot easier than metal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it certainly has killed a number of people and animals when it's oozed out of the ground. And what's that lake in Africa that periodically erupts carbon dioxide? Oh, I know. Let's concentrate it all, strip off the oxygen, and make diamonds, guys. Why so narrow thinking?
But see, here's the problem, Margaret. The reason that we've got energy from this stuff is the chemical reaction of carbon plus oxygen equals heat plus carbon dioxide.
Yes, I know.
And so, you know, you can't reverse that chemical reaction and not have to give up all the energy you just got, plus some.
Yes, but that's a good point to make, because a lot of people think carbon, they're thinking a brick of coal. They're not understanding that we're talking about carbon dioxide sequestration, not carbon.
Right. And
that's
the
a good
other
point. It's so obvious to us, those technical people, but you're right, that might not be obvious to the people we're trying to talk to, that when we're talking carbon sequestration, it's not as easy. I never thought about it that way. Thanks.
Yeah, and so it becomes a safe thing, right? Because I'm just boxing up a brick of coal. That's okay. It's not going to go anywhere. But when you start to talk about carbon dioxide and how volatile it is and how dangerous it is, maybe you start to change the conversation. It's similar to the one I've been trying to get people to understand, is the radioactive spent fuel is no more dangerous and less dangerous than the remains of a photovoltaic panel.
Right. Oh, I say that all the time. That's great. And actually, per kilowatt hour produced, solar has about as much, generates about the same amount of toxic waste as nuclear.
Right. And people goggle a little bit when you say that. And then when you add to the fact that, oh, and by the way, that resulting waste never goes away. It doesn't decay ever.
At the UN Climate Change Conference in 2005, I had a woman from the Green Party in Europe just about come over the table and attack me when I was telling her about the toxic waste from solar. She told me I'm a liar.
Really?
What I was interested in hearing about was the decommissioning trust fund for wind turbines and solar panels. Who's going to pay for that?
You mean who's going to remove those 400-ton anchors that they put into the ground?
Right. I mean, in 5 or 6 years, you know, after we build up our solar panel and wind farm infrastructure and then it all fails because it's not cost-effective without massive government subsidies, and the people who bought them will not be able to afford to maintain them to keep them running. Then
mention Altamont Pass? Have you been to Altamont Pass recently? They're still sitting there.
And oh, by the way, I don't want to put anybody on the spot here, but I will admit that I am old enough to remember a tremendous period of building solar panels and rooftop collectors and all that stuff in the late 1970s. And probably just about 4 years later, people were having to pay contractors to come and take the leaky things off the roof.
That's why I became a nuclear engineer, was the energy crisis of the 70s. At least I'm in a field that made sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against wind and solar if we can make them work, but you know, let's compare apples to apples here and evaluate each energy technology by the same set of criteria and see what works.
Well, one of the things that just drives me nuts is when people tell me that the wind and solar industries are new and they need help, just like the atomic energy industry did in its early days. I said, I'm sorry, but I think that humans have known that the wind and the sun have energy for several thousands of years. We've been capturing it and using it.
Well,
so don't tell me that those are new industries.
And to the other half of that point is, I'm sorry, but commercial wind and solar panels were being developed at the same time that the first commercial nuclear power plants were being developed. So even if you want to go apples to apples on commercialization of the whole thing, they're the same age.
Well, but that's not really true because I've been in Holland, which had turbines in the 1600s.
Yeah, no, you're right. But I'm talking about the solar panels and the discovery of the way a solar panel works is about the same era as, because it's the same physics, if you will, of fission. It's knocking around the core of the atom a little bit.
Well, actually, I think the photoelectric effect was discovered in the 1880s, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. But the idea that remember that computers, the whole digital and the semiconductor, which is the fundamental of the photovoltaic, came around in the 50s, about the same age. The point being, the commercial is that you can't make the argument that it's new. It's not shiny and new. It's just that this generation's never heard of it before.
I want to offer a little factoid, a little humor here in all of this, and that is that for uranium enrichment plants, one of the outputs is depleted uranium in the form of UF6, and that there's a fellow here in Idaho Falls named Steve Laffin with a company called International Isotopes that's building a $55 million plant in Hobbs, New Mexico, to extract high-purity fluorine from the UF6 and sell it back to industry. Guess who one of the primary buyers of the fluorine is? It's the solar energy industry in order to etch the chips. So I think it's somewhat serendipitous and a little bit ironic that the solar industry supply chain comes from the nuclear industry.
That's hysterical.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to touch on, Dan, you said it a few minutes ago, but I think that there are a number of, if you want to take a look at the strengths and weaknesses of solar and wind technology, and then you kind of line them up against the strengths and weaknesses of nuclear. And I think if the nuclear industry and the renewable industry kind of put their heads together, there would be an opportunity for synergy there. you know, if you say, okay, we want to have some wind, we want to have some solar, let's figure out how to make it work. And you take a look at the transmission line capacities and how you're going to keep the transmission lines loaded, and the need to modulate other power sources to in opposition to the intermittency of wind and solar. And the small reactor really becomes, you know, moves to the head of the pack in terms of the best way to work opposite of wind and solar.
You could pair
perhaps 5 or 6 small modular reactors and 100 or 200 megawatts of wind turbine into a hybrid wind nuclear energy facility, put it out in a place where the transmission lines are perhaps already there, or build a new transmission line. Then you can keep the transmission lines loaded. You can let your small reactors modulate in opposition to the wind, and you can have a completely 100% carbon-free power plant.
Okay, I'm going to take a different tact. I understand where you're coming from, and I think that's a wonderful vision. I just don't understand why you bother with the wind. From my point of view, I've operated a grid that was 100% nuclear and worked just fine. Yeah. It modulated its power up and down. And it only took one reactor, by the way, to do that. So
yeah, actually, Dwayne Arnold operated. Dwayne Arnold in the Midwest operated in a load follow mode in the mid '80s for a number of years because Iowa didn't need the electricity and they weren't tied into the broader need in the Midwest and the Chicago area yet. So they operated load follow quite successfully. There are some limits, but they're not insurmountable.
Well, I've operated both military reactors and commercial reactors, and I know that that is a myth that even large reactors can load follow quite well if thought is put into it in advance.
Right.
And you have to design your support systems,
right,
to be able to adapt for that. But they,
right,
do in France all the time.
Right. So my basic philosophy is, the only alliance that I think I'll ever be successful in organizing is one that allies nuclear suppliers with electricity customers. I don't think I'll ever find any energy suppliers who will be friends with me, at least, because I just don't see the point.
Well, to your point about why bother with wind or solar, Rod, is I think the decision to use wind and solar energy is a political one, not necessarily a technical one or a financial one. So if you accept the fact that politically we're going to use wind and solar and we're put in a position to figure out how to do it best, then the best way to do it is to pair them with nuclear power plants.
Let me make the case for California. Earlier this year, Governor Schwarzenegger told the utilities that they had to, in terms of importing their electricity to the state, that 20% of it had to be renewable, and he included nuclear in the definition of renewable because it is a carbon emission-free technology. Now, I talked at length about this with Aaron Tilton, who is the CEO of the Blue Castle Project, previously called Transition Power, which is seeking to build a nuclear power plant in Utah. And the reason they're doing this is because the city of Los Angeles pulled out of the construction of Intermountain Power 3, which was going to be a 900-megawatt coal-fired power plant, because they had a mandate on the books, just as John was talking about, a political mandate, not to invest in any more greenhouse gas-emitting power plants. So the folks who were at Intermountain went to work for Transition Power. And they are now going to jump on the governor's executive order that designates nuclear as a renewable source. And they have contracted with Enercon to submit an early site permit to begin developing the rationale and the licensing for at least 3,000 megawatts of nuclear-powered electricity generation in Utah, of which the bulk of which, at least 2,000 of the 3,000, will be shipped off to keep the lights on in Los Angeles. So I find it ironic The designation of nuclear as renewable because it's carbon emission free is sparking the prospects for a nuclear power plant in Utah, the same way demand for energy from Los Angeles previously sparked the development of coal-fired power plants.
I have to say that the image of having to bring wind along for the ride with nuclear because that's what politics expects makes me think of those people that get into carpool lanes with blow up dolls in the passenger seat.
Or the pregnant women that drive there and say, "I'm carrying." Yeah.
Well, you know that I have a friend who's from Holland, and he told me about a very large wind turbine that is right alongside a freeway there. And that wind turbine never stops turning because it really is a billboard that is motorized. So it does sound like your blow-up doll.
I heard about that when they needed to motorize it because they didn't want it to be stopped when people drove by.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's really sad.
Well, and you know, unlike John, I like politics. I like political decision making, and I think that the real alliance that you can make is if you can figure out how to convince people that nuclear energy will save them money, and simply not wasting money on building useless wind and solar systems is the right way to go. And if we start building nuclear plants and we get economies of unit production down, and we do like we've done with almost every technology I can think of, drive down the cost after the first units are in, we really can build a very strong coalition that will have some amount of political strength against the people that like to sell coal, oil, and gas.
You know, one of the things that came out of the ANS conference was a comment by Craig Piercy, who represents ANS in Washington. And he said, you know, for a long time, the nuclear industry has been saying that climate change is one of the reasons that we should build more nuclear power plants. But he says that's exactly the strongest position. He says there's one that's actually is stronger, and that is the national security angle. The U.S. used to be a leader in nuclear technology, and now we're not. The French, Russians and the Chinese are clearly way ahead of us in their investments. And the U.S., he says, needs to be engaged in the global nuclear energy world because it serves our national security interests, not only because it provides for exports and the growth of jobs at home, but because it fully engages us in the way these technologies are managed on an international basis. And I think he's got a point.
I think that Tom Sanders' point about right-sized reactors is excellent. He keeps making that very same point about getting the U.S. leadership back so that we have a place at the table and we can have some influence on how technology develops. But he believes that one of our real strengths in the U.S. is the fact that we have a large cadre of people who understand small reactors, moderately sized reactors, and we have the inherent ability to be leaders in that kind of new or different way to develop reactors.
Yeah, he made an interesting point that we make all these 1-2-3 agreements with other countries, and the whole premise behind those agreements is the other countries get nuclear technology to help them build up their energy independence and their infrastructure. And in exchange, the United States gets an assurance that the co-signers of the agreements will not seek to develop their own enrichment capability, which hypothetically could prevent them from building a weapons infrastructure.
What's going on with the United Arab Emirates right now. Their 1-2-3 agreement has just cleared Congress in October, and they are on the verge of awarding $20 billion in contracts. One of the things about these 1-2-3 agreements is that while we're signing them, other countries' nuclear infrastructure are benefiting. In the case of India, they signed an agreement in December 2008 with the Russians for 4.8 gigawatts of new technology, and with the French for 3.2 gigawatts. No American firms have signed agreements with India for the construction of new reactors. In the UAE, it appears, as Rod has pointed out, that we'll have a combination of Areva selling the reactors and the South Koreans doing the construction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Tom's point in all this was it's very important for the United States to maintain a technological lead, something to sell.
We'd have to regain it.
Right. That's
true. I was going to say,
reactors represents an opportunity to regain that lead. So,
yes.
Go ahead.
I would say the South Koreans have passed up the U.S. fleet operationally, too. Their capacity factor is higher and their unplanned shutdown rate is lower. That was a shock to me when at the ANS meeting and the International Committee meeting on Saturday night.
That's pretty impressive because both of those measures in the U.S. are pretty darn high. So the South Koreans must be doing a hell of a job.
They are.
Yeah, that's impressive. I didn't know that. Let's talk about some of the other highlights of the ANS meeting. One of the things that I had a couple of things that I really enjoyed, other than the blogger podcaster event, which was really a great experience. But I had had the opportunity to pass over a check for $25,000 to the American Nuclear Society student conference organizers on the behalf of the charitable trust of Entergy, who is my daytime employer. And that was a lot of fun to know that we're supporting that student conference.
Huh? Yeah, a posse of students following you around after that.
Yeah, I know. That was like a super. I was like a rock star after that. That was funny.
That must have been fun.
It was fun. No,
I've seen some of those students.
They're really bright, energetic people, and to any students who happen to be listening to this podcast later, I really, really encourage you to go to the ANS student conference meeting. It'll be held in University of Michigan in April. The other thing that happened that was interesting,
you did a podcast on that from the last meeting, didn't you?
I did, and I actually have an update video that I took of updating some of the information that I'll probably get out in the next week or so. Another video of that. And the other thing that happened I thought was very interesting is an old friend of mine who's been in the industry for 20 plus years stopped in one evening. Actually, it was the same evening as the blogger meeting, and he had not been to an ANS meeting in many years, and he was really struck by the excitement that was there and the people that were there to meet and talk to. And just in one evening, he at the end of the evening said, "Man, I've really been missing a lot. I'm going to start coming to these events. Even if my employer won't pay for me to come, I'm going to come on my own dime." And so I thought that was a real credit to what was going on there. And it was interesting because he ended up running into a lot of his old acquaintances that he had not seen for years and was able to make connections. And so, you know, we always learn a lot.
He's making a lot of money.
What's that?
He must be making a lot of money if he's willing to pay for this.
Well,
hey, I've been going on my own dime, well, sort of, for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went on my own dime this time. It's worth every penny.
Right.
It's great to be there.
So, you know, besides the technical stuff that we all learn, and it really is the relationships that we build and the people that you run into that you can use and continue to work together, you know, between meetings and in the future is really what makes the ANS meetings a success, I think.
One of the things that I found just really exciting is when I first started attending ANS meetings back in the mid-1990s, actually a little bit early 1990s, fully half of the sessions were on D&D, decommissioning and decontamination. And I'm just happy as all get out that we're talking about building new things.
Absolutely.
One of the things I think that's kind of interesting is the day after the blogger soiree, I had a chance to talk for about an hour with a former ANS president, Dr. Marcus, is now has her own blog,
At Nuclear Power Talk.
All right, thanks. I was getting there. she asked me, what should I blog about? She's already blogging quite well. I don't know if she needed my help. And I said, you've been involved in the signature issues of the reemergence of nuclear energy. You don't have to drop names. Just blog about what you know. And that's what she's going to do. And I think it's really nice to see that you have both the younger crowd supported by John and his company and the leadership are both converging in the same kind of communication tools.
Dr. Marcus is writing a book, too.
Really?
Nope. I don't know what the title is, but she told me about it. Should be interesting. Yeah,
Dr. Marcus is an impressive lady. I believe she's the first woman to earn a PhD in nuclear engineering in the United States.
Was she? Wow.
That's what her blog says.
Oh, well, then it's probably true.
Yeah, well, she is a contemporary, I think, with Shirley Jackson, who was on the NRC, who also earned a PhD, but I think hers was in nuclear physics on the science side, but also at MIT.
Yep, they're definitely two different degrees, and I think that's the distinction. There were certainly other PhDs in nuclear subjects before, but Dr. Marcus was the first in nuclear engineering. So,
anyway, one thing she also talked about, she was concerned about whether or not this blogger group would become some kind of rump group with an agenda or run out and wave banners in front of NRC hearings or something. And I assured her that we weren't going to do that.
Told that we weren't going to be coming to NRC hearings. What?
No, I said
waving banners and
waving
protesters.
Banners. Waving banners. But
waving banners at NRC hearings.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do, isn't it, Lisa?
Yeah.
I think I've stepped into something I was headed towards. What I'm trying to get at is that ANS and a lot of people in ANS see it as a professional scientific society, which doesn't have a strong advocacy role. Yet at the same time, when you see people in the senior leadership like Dr. Marcus getting into blogging, in fact, de facto, it is a form of advocacy. And Lisa, I think you were the person who said that anytime you have a conversation with someone and you make the point about nuclear and they get it, that's one less person who's opposed to nuclear energy. I think blogs do that.
Now, I was just talking about, I want people to go to NRC public meetings and such and make themselves known, although, they don't always let us bring in banners and signs, especially if we have sticks attached to the signs that they think we can be used as weapons. I tell people all the time to go to the public meetings and write the letters and all that, do all the grassroots tactics that the other side uses. But be respectful and be technically accurate. So.
And the other thing, the other real advantage, I think, that people who really get the industry and really deeply understand the technology, it's hard not to talk about it without excitement, because it really is amazingly cool stuff. I keep a little fuel pellet on my desk for inspiration and remind myself that's equivalent to about 1,800 gallons of diesel fuel. In terms of energy.
Yeah.
So
actually, also to your point, Dan, did you guys realize that Thursday morning at the conference, the Young Generation Nuclear did an advocacy day on the Hill?
I went to
the Hill and talked to legislative assistants with two congressmen and one senator from North Carolina. And in my case, all three were at least leaning pro. The senator is the new senator from North Carolina, and she's still kind of learning. But so it was a good day. I felt sorry for the California delegation because they got assigned Nancy Pelosi.
I got to stop saying we because I'm not young generation anymore. But with our workshop that we usually have in May, or that NAYJ usually has in May, they usually organize hill visits for the past few years when it's in Washington, D.C., to take people up in groups. And also Women in Nuclear does the same type of thing. They usually do it in the spring where people come to D.C. and they have sort of a half-day briefing and then groups go on the Hill. And that's really effective to go talk to those aides, put a face on nuclear, let them know that you're a technical asset, if they want to use you for information or whatever. Again, just putting the face on it. It's not just old white guys in dark suits that are out there, the greedy corporations. It's people of all walks of life that are supportive of nuclear. So I highly encourage people to get on the Hill and just talk about what you do.
Well, what was so exciting about this was it was actually part of the ANS event, and we went to the Hill saying we are members of the American Nuclear Society and we're here to talk to you about nuclear.
Did you have a bunch of buttons or something to
We all had stickers on that said my day is powered by nuclear energy or something like that. It was like the secret handshake as we walked around. We recognized each other. It wasn't as well attended as I would have liked to have seen. There was a number of no-shows at the last minute, but nonetheless, it was exciting to know that the American Nuclear Society was finally recognizing that it has a role as a grassroots advocacy organization for nuclear energy. The NEI is the corporate suits. The NEI are the corporate suits, and that what's been key missing ingredient is people like us that have believed and have grown up and went to school believing that nuclear energy was the right thing to do, and going up to on the Hill and saying, hey, I joined the nuclear industry in 1981 after 4 years of college getting a degree. And oh, by the way, I did that because in the 1970s, there was this thing called the oil crisis.
Hey, Margaret, we're classmates.
Yeah, I didn't want to admit that. and I said, but I said to one of these young staffers, there was an oil crisis in the 70s. I did a write-up on this in the paper in my alumnus magazine, that I drove a car with ethanol-laced gasoline in 1977. Why? Because there was an oil crisis.
I waited in line for gas in 1974.
Yeah, I remember
with my
that
dad.
Too. And so here we are again, and we didn't do the job right the first time. Let's get it right this time. And it was interesting to watch him say, oh, it's not just because I had the experience to back up the conversation. The young folks were great, but they didn't have all that knowledge of there's a history here that you guys have forgotten that's important. And it was fun. I left cards all over the place. I hope I get a call back from some of them. I also took cards, so they're going to hear from me.
That sounds terrific. Did anybody else get to go to that event?
No, I really wish I would have.
Now, it's taken a long time to get ANS to be supportive of advocacy efforts because, well, there's a long history. That's probably another podcast of why leadership has felt like doing that kind of thing may not be within the mission or vision of ANS. But it's come around, and I'm glad to see it.
Yeah, it certainly seems like the leaders, at least recently, have been more interested in outreach, and Tom Sanders certainly is not shy at all about getting up and talking about his visions for the future in front of a group of folks and knocking heads and shaking hands and saying, hey, let's go. So, hey, I really appreciate the time that all of you have given to me. I think it's been a wonderful conversation. I hope that we get together again at some time. Hopefully, you all will respond to my emails when I get a decision to get together, because it's fun. Besides that, I don't have too much preparation when I bring people like you on.
Yeah, I'm learning that trick from you, Rod. If I could just get somebody to come on and talk, then I don't have to figure out what I'm going to talk about.
You work so hard on your podcast, John. I think it's wonderful that people... I've never been a very hard worker, so what can I say?
It's called efficiency, Rod. You tell people you're very efficient.
I tell people I'm a lazy cheapskate.
I've told them that too, and it just doesn't get me nearly the respect of looking at them and saying, I'm an efficiency expert.
Yeah, I just believe, quite honestly, one of my philosophies in life is that a good engineer is a lazy cheapskate. They don't like to do things more than once if they don't have to, and they try to make things cost less, but they recognize that costing less doesn't mean using cheap materials, because if you use cheap materials, you have to do the darn thing over again.
Right.
So anyway, thank you all.
Right.
I hope you have a terrific week, and maybe, let's see, the next ANS meeting is in June in San Diego.
That's right.
And there's some other exciting events coming up, and we'll be talking about those along the way. And let's keep the nuclear renaissance humming so that we can make a liar out of Harvey Wasserman.
You betcha.
Right. I'm sorry. I can't really do that because, never mind.
Can't make a liar out of somebody who already is?
Oh, I wasn't going to say that.
But okay. Hey, I will.
All right, well, everybody have a great night.
All right, okay. Take care.
Good
Bye,
night.
Everybody. Bye-bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way. Such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.